This Israel Report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Good morning, Anthony Reich. What have you got for us this morning?
Boker Tov, Chanukah Sameach, Simon. I know that you guys already had a discussion about the $35 billion gas deal that Israel has signed with Egypt. I think what's important to note here is less about the gas and more about the relationships in the Middle East, because what's interesting behind the story is that the United States has really been pushing Israel to somehow conclude this deal in order to somehow bring Israel a little closer to Egypt and facilitate a meeting that is due to take place, we understand, between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Egyptian President El-Sisi towards the end of this month in the US. So we'll see how that goes and how the gas might have lit the fire under that relationship in order to try and pursue it. But what I wanted to jump onto was a highly controversial bill that's being advanced through the Knesset at the moment, which is all about Jewish law and Jewish practices in public. And I just wonder what listeners think about this, because this really has two distinct sides to the story. The Knesset voted yesterday to advance a bill which is labeled, the headline, it's called Realization of Jewish Identity in the Public Sphere. And the idea of this bill is to allow Israelis to feel more free to express their national and religious identity in public in Israel. Now, the fact that we need to actually have a bill to guarantee that right seems to be strange to me, because when I walk around the street and I see the Chanukiot and I see the mezuzot on all the doors and I see people walking around with their kippah and I see people stopping their car on the side of the road in order to pray, because the sun will go down soon and they'll miss their opportunity, and nobody says a word or bat an eyelid, nobody interferes with their right to do so, I sort of wonder why we need to have a law which guarantees our right to express our Jewish identity in public. This bill, however, potentially goes a little bit further than that. It mandates the installation of a mezuzah on the doors of all public institutions. It criminalizes interfering with Jewish Orthodox religious practices in public spaces. And quite interestingly, it also requires civil court judges to pass tests proving their knowledge of Jewish religious law. Now, that last sentence is likely to be removed from the bill as it progresses through the Knesset, because that seems to be one of those bits that's been added on in order to be taken away, negotiated away from the agreement. But here's the thing. I mean, I know that we've had a lot of controversial incidents, many of them before the war, when there were attempts to try to have public prayer services, particularly on Yom Kippur, on the streets of Tel Aviv. And there were people who were very opposed to it and went through and tried to destroy this particular practice, and others who were very insistent on being able to. I just think that somewhere we need to have kind of reasonable tolerance of what other people want to get up to without forcing it upon anybody and without infringing upon anybody's right to do what they're doing, so long as they're not forcing upon you or interfering with your rights not to do that, if that's what you choose to do. And I just think that it's a little bit of a shame that we have to have this going through the Knesset rather than trying to educate people to be a little bit more tolerant of each other. Don't push it down somebody's throat when it's not welcome. Don't force it upon them. Don't encroach upon their private area, their private space. But on the other hand, allow people to do whatever they want to do, so long as you can do whatever you want to do, right? Isn't that kind of the way of the world? Isn't that what we should be trying to get towards as an objective? I don't know. I think it's a little sad.
Just a reflection of the culture wars that are going on in Israel.
I think that's correct. I think that is absolutely correct. And, you know, we come back all the time to this notion of Israel is a Jewish state. Okay, how Jewish is the Jewish state? And how far does that go? In other words, does it mean we don't have buses and public transportation on Shabbat? Or does it mean that we don't have buses and public transportation on Shabbat for those who don't want that? But for those who do, and for those who don't have alternative days during the week when they can go about doing rest and relaxation, and they need public transportation in order to achieve that, is it right in the Jewish state that we should provide those people the opportunity to do that, even though it transgresses Shabbat? I mean, this is an ongoing debate, and I do welcome people getting involved and having their say, because in recent years, I mean, it's been a tradition in Israel in most areas that public transportation doesn't work on Shabbat. In recent months, there have been certain lines that have been set up on Shabbat, which are even free of charge in many areas, allowing people to move around on Shabbat, because not everybody has a car and not everybody has the opportunity to have their rest and relaxation, go to the beach or to do whatever they need to do on days which are not Shabbat. Many people here work 5.5 or 6 days a week. And so Shabbat comes, they're not observant. They want to go about doing their daily business. I mean, I don't know. I'm certainly not taking a point of view here, other than the point of view which says tolerance. Just be tolerant of what other people want. Do what you want. Insist that you have the right to do what you want, as long as it doesn't encroach upon anybody else's space. That's my view.
Yeah, it just kind of does seem related to all the issues going on in Israel. Now I'm thinking about judicial reform. I'm thinking about those who established the state, who had a particular view of what it should be, and those who felt marginalized and didn't have the input that perhaps they should have had, and who are now a very powerful constituency. And that's what I see playing out in this particular attempt.
What's interesting, if you go back to the original establishment of the state, I mean, those Zionists who were real Zionists who dreamt about a state of Israel before it existed, and the Yeshuv and those who were here and really fought in the War of Independence and battled until the state was eventually declared, many of them were secular. David Ben-Gurion amongst them, even Menachem Begin, who was a prime minister and well-respected, was a secular prime minister, but interestingly invited people to come to the prime minister's residence in Jerusalem every Shabbat afternoon. The prime minister's residence was open to everybody. All citizens of Israel who wanted to visit were allowed to go to the prime minister's residence on Shabbat afternoon and visit and have tea in the prime minister's residence in the garden. And then traditionally, there would be Havdalah at the end of the afternoon, when there would be a formal separation of Shabbat and regular days of the week. And then the prime minister would request everybody to go home and to get on with their week and allow him to get on with his week. And he was not religious. It's just how much we want to really cling on to our Jewish practices. Many of those who are secular in our society today don't really want to. They're sort of rejecting in many respects the traditional practices. But there are enough people in Israel who are religious in the first instance and want to continue the practices, or those who are even not religious but still want to continue practices. And I often relate to how many people fast, for example, on Yom Kippur. There is a very massive percentage of Israelis, even those who are secular, who fast on Yom Kippur, who do want to hang on to those traditional practices. How many people in Israel light Hanukkah candles? Most of the country, religious, secular, whoever you want, light Hanukkah candles. How many people attend a Pesach Seder? Most of Israelis attend a Pesach Seder, even those who have no idea what the Pesach story is about, and even those who don't even read anything, but they get together and they celebrate the Leil HaSeder, the night of the Seder, as a traditional practice. So I think inherently people do want to cling on to tradition. However, you know, we are, as you rightly point out, in a very difficult situation in trying to resolve this issue.
Anthony, if you don't mind, I'd love to circle back to the issue of the gas deal. We did speak about the rands and cents and the investment and strategic implications for the region, but there's something that wasn't answered to my satisfaction. And that is, why would Israel agree to a deal of this magnitude without conditioning it on some sort of improved normalization with Egypt? You're giving them $34 billion worth of gas. Surely the incitement in the press, surely the incitement by government needs to stop. It can't be a one-way deal.
Well, I think the question, Simon, is to what extent Israel can expect Egypt to make a public statement like that and still fulfill this role of intermediary, because I think that Egypt's intermediary role between Israel and the Gaza factions, Hamas, whoever will ultimately rise up in Gaza, I think that that relationship is really important. And Israel has used it over the years, and specifically during this war, when Israel wasn't willing to communicate with Hamas. And yet we wanted to get our hostages home, and we did want to send certain messages to Hamas, and we did want to reach certain agreements with them. And the only way that we could really do that is to use Egypt as a more trusted intermediary, and Qatar as a slightly less trusted intermediary. Now, if you expect Egypt to stand up and say, we are going to be supportive of Israel and we are so grateful for this $35 billion of gas and we're going to reject Hamas and we're going to, then you can't expect Egypt to continue to have any credibility in fulfilling that intermediary role. And ultimately, we need Egypt quietly to say to Israel, we're supporting you, we're going to buy your gas. We are not going to make any public statements about how much we're supporting you. We are going to continue to still make ourselves available to those factions in Gaza who need the communication and potentially other groupings within the Arab world. And so for that reason, we are not going to make any public statements in this vein that you've suggested that we would naturally wish to hear from them. We're going to just allow that to be under the radar. And I think in the Middle East and in politics in the Middle East, a lot is unsaid. A lot is understood, but unsaid, and certainly not said out in public. And so we don't really know exactly what lies in the small print, in the quiet diplomacy beneath the steel. There is a lot. The headlines are really just very much the tip of the iceberg. Trust me that there is a huge amount that's under the water at the moment that we have no visibility of, and it'll be interesting to see how that comes out over the next few years.
Fascinating, fascinating. All right, let's move on to the story about Naftali Bennett apparently had his phone hacked. I seem to recall this isn't the first such story like this that I've read.
So what's interesting here is that this is a group called Handala, which has advertised that it has managed to hack Naftali Bennett's phone. And they're very proud in being able to do that because, of course, Israel prides itself in cybersecurity, and Naftali Bennett himself has been very personally involved in, you know, cybersecurity issues. And he himself had a company that had a big exit. And, you know, he's definitely part of that Israeli ecosystem of cybersecurity. And lo and behold, here it comes out that his personal phone has been hacked. Initially, Naftali Bennett said, no, my phone hasn't been hacked. And then he kind of said, well, it's not my phone that's been hacked, but it's my Telegram account that was hacked. And then they kind of started to advertise so much information about his list of contacts and other things that clearly wouldn't have been related to his Telegram account. So it's a little embarrassing. And what I understand is that it actually wasn't his phone that was hacked, but potentially a backup that is held somewhere on a computer, which contains the information of his phone, because of course, every good cybersecurity person knows that you need to keep your phone backed up at all times. And apparently it's the backup that ultimately was hacked. And I'm sure that there must be a very, very simple solution to keep that safe, but for some reason it wasn't implemented. So this is certainly a little embarrassing. And of course, Naftali Bennett has been relatively public in recent weeks, months, because it seems as if though he is preparing himself for another run at being the prime minister when we have our elections next year. So this is definitely a little embarrassing. I'm sure that there's simple ways to sort this out, but for now at least, it seems like a lot of people's information has been published by Handala in public, including the leaders of countries around the world, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and the head of the International Nuclear Committee and so many other well-known individuals apparently whose information has been published out there by Handala to show that they've actually managed to get onto his phone. Really embarrassing.
Embarrassing and scary stuff to know that there's vulnerabilities at that sort of level. Anthony Wright,
absolutely.
We're going to leave it there. We're out of time, but thank you so much for your input this morning. Always, always, always appreciate it. And that gives me about 30 seconds or so before we need to go to news. So very quickly, I want to go to the WhatsApp line where I think Unsigned is weighing in and he says, Anthony, nonsense. Egypt is an enemy country. They are hoping to defeat Israel per Egyptian political and defense analysts. Stop being naive. Anthony, you're in very good company because I get called naive. I think it's Clive by the same person. Maybe you've got a point. I mean, I don't know what Egypt's end game is. I really don't. The time is 8 o'clock, though. It's time to take the news.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands.